Hi, and welcome to Three Worlds Podcast number 12. It's been ages and ages and ages since I've done a podcast, and I do apologise about that. I mean, what can I say, really? Except, I'm ever so sorry. I'm ever so sorry. It's been such a long time. But it has. It's been summer here. Well, kind of. I mean, it's been wet but slightly warmer than the winter, and I've got another issue of the magazine out, issue 57, which came out about 3 weeks ago or something thereabouts, and I have just returned from the first residential conference for shamanic practitioners in the UK, held under the banner of the Society for Shamanic Practitioners in the States, which I think is a wonderful organisation, and I recommend everybody kind of goes and visits their websites and joins, becomes a member of the shamanic practitioners. Well, the conference was a great success. It was held over sort of 3.5 days or thereabouts at Glastonbury, a centre just south of Glastonbury. And there were all sorts of different people there, including a most inspiring Nepalese shaman who I will be doing an interview with in Sacred Hoop, probably next issue, or more likely actually the one afterwards, which will be out early next year. Now, other bits and pieces at the conference included Karen Kelly, who is a UK-based shamanic practitioner who I've known for many years. She lives over from England's sort of east coast at Cambridge, and she has made quite a study of the Viking shamanic practice of Side. And there's various ways of pronouncing it, but I have it on absolute authority from her that that's the correct way of saying it. It's like a side of meat, side, as in not the front, not the back, but the side. And while I was at the conference, I actually took part in a side ritual that Karen ran. And afterwards, I talked to her about it. And that's going to be the bulk of this podcast. These podcasts will continue to happen, but my plan was that I would do one about every 2 weeks. And that's obviously completely failed. Partially because I'm just too busy getting the magazine together, really. So I'm going to try and aim at one every month, which is actually how it's averaged out at the last sort of over the last year. We started in September last year, and it's September this year, and this is episode 12. So, hey, I can do maths. So my partner Jan has retired from the magazine now, so it's kind of all in my lap, so I have a little bit less time, which is part of the reason why I haven't done one in the last 3 months or so. But please don't unsubscribe. We're going to be continuing to do the podcast. So I think perhaps now is a good time to listen to the interview that I did with Karen. Now, this was recorded on a mini disc recorder outside at the conference. We actually had a hot afternoon, and Karen and I sort of skived off from a session, and we sat in the courtyard of the centre where we were, and we drank several cups of coffee and recorded a really rather wonderful interview, which didn't record. So we then pretended that we hadn't recorded it, and we recorded it again, and this one did. So I want to say a huge thanks to Karen for having the patience to sit there and be interviewed twice, and pretending the second time that I hadn't actually interviewed her the first time and it wasn't a repeat. Oh, isn't technology wonderful when it doesn't work? Anyway, this is not quite the same quality as my normal podcasts, and in fact this little bit isn't either. I'm doing this for speed. I'm just simply plugging a microphone into my Apple Mac computer rather than recording it in my recording studio, so it's not quite the same clarity, but it's good enough for now, and it's a lot easier for me because I can actually see it recording on the screen in front of me as I speak, and I shall then go back through and edit all the coffee and bits where I go wrong and things like that. So without further ado, here is the interview with Karen.
So I'm joined by Karen Kelly, and Karen does a practice called Side, which is it's Viking, yeah?
Yes, it's a Norse or Viking shamanic practice.
Okay.
It's pretty well written about in some of the Viking sagas.
Okay.
And it encompasses a whole range of different, if you like any shamanic tradition.
Okay.
I think calling it a practice is probably better to call it a tradition.
All right.
In the same way that perhaps medicine work is a tradition,
right.
I would say side is a tradition that brings together a whole range of different practices.
And I guess it would have been practiced across the whole of the sort of Viking world, which really stretched right into Russia and I guess even potentially across into North America, into Vinland.
Yeah, there are stories of side or of female singing seeresses.
Right.
From all the way from, there's a really early Roman story of such seeresses on the Danube.
Okay, yeah.
Right across to obviously Scandinavia, Iceland and Greenland. And in fact, in Eric the Red's saga, they talk very clearly about a vulva, which is what these seeresses are called. And Eric the Red saga is the same saga that talks about the founding of Vinland.
Okay,
or finding
that was,
Vinland.
So. What, 12th century, 13th century?
Yeah, it was 13th century. So it's right at the end of the if you like, the pagan period.
Okay,
or it's past
when they were
the
becoming
end.
Christianized.
So very
yeah.
much so.
Yeah.
And in fact, when, to be honest, Norway, Britain were long Christian. And it was only the kind of outposts of Iceland and Greenland that still had this mixed pagan and Christian community.
But this would have been practiced in Britain, so it's something that we can look on in these islands as a definite shamanic tradition from this place, even though it was brought over by the Viking invaders. But
yeah, in fact, probably, you know, one of the most famous practitioners of Side or Seid was a woman called Gunhilda, who was the wife of Eric Bloodaxe, the Queen of York. In fact, the famous Queen of York. If you go to York, there's lots of stuff about Eric Bloodaxe.
Right, because York was a major Viking city. Jorvik?
Jorvik. And she was also, her husband was also various times King of Norway.
Right.
And there's lots of stories of her doing different forms of seid, from sort of doing magic on people to being able to shapeshift, and indeed that's one of the common practices within the Seid tradition,
right,
is Hamran, which is shapeshifting.
Okay, what did you call it?
Hamran, I think.
Hamran.
Shapeshifting, the story is, even one of the stories says that Odin would lie under a blanket,
yeah,
and his soul would fare forth in the form of an animal.
Okay. Very shamanic.
Very shamanic. And Queen Gunhilda, there's one point in one of the sagas where her husband's enemies are in a tower plotting, and they look out outside and they see this nightingale listening at the window.
Okay.
And they know it's Queen Gunhilda in her spirit form, in her animal form.
Yeah. So nightingale was obviously one of her sort of helpers, as it were. Yeah.
But there's a lot of other Viking leaders who were known to be able to shapeshift.
Okay.
Particularly often, if there were blokes, it was often into wolves.
Right, something manly.
Yeah, something manly.
So, Side is obviously a female tradition, a woman's tradition.
It is and it isn't.
Okay.
Women were the main practitioners of Side in the sagas. And indeed, they're the sort of practitioners of Side who get, if you like, the most thumbs up from the, they're the most okay people.
Right, so it was all right if you're a woman and you wanted to do that.
Yeah, and you were doing it for your community, and then maybe it was okay.
Right.
If you were a man, it wasn't okay to practice Seid. In fact, it was considered very unmanly to do there's a story that Freya was the goddess who first knew Seid.
Okay.
And Freya is one of the Vanir. She's one of the fertility goddesses. Or she is the fertility goddess, the goddess of love.
Right.
The goddess that's connected with, if you like, the raw, ecstatic power of nature.
Okay, yeah.
She taught Seid to Odin.
Okay, because obviously Odin is the king of the gods.
The king of the gods, but he's a very shamanic deity.
Okay.
And he's shamanic because he practices Seid.
Yeah.
And But it was okay for her to practice Sais, but it wasn't really okay for Odin to do so.
Okay.
And there's a very nice scene in one of the sagas where Loki is having a bit of a contest with the other gods, and he's insulting them.
Yeah, Loki's the trickster. Yeah.
And he's insulting all the other gods, and he's saying, you know, just about as bad things as can be said about him. And what he comes up with Odin is, you know, I hear that you practice Sais on Samsay. Samsay's an island.
Right.
And I hear that you beat on a drum like a vulva.
Right.
And I think that, and he says, I think that's Ergi. And Ergi means perverted. And okay. It means perverted in the sense of effeminate.
Okay.
In the sense of being involved in homosexuality from the recipient point of view.
Okay.
And that was really seriously not okay.
No,
in Viking
times. Macho, yeah, yeah.
If you were a man, you had to be very macho.
Yeah, yeah. So he's a real deviant for doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's like deviant. Yeah. And I think the reason for that is, you know, as I said, Sais is connected with Freya. It's connected with this raw nature power. And I'm sure a lot of us, when doing deep shamanic work, have connected with that very raw nature power.
Yeah.
You know, when the Native Americans say, like, be like a hollow bone,
yes.
Let it just flow through
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
It's that power that you're letting flow
yeah.
through you, the power of the universe.
Yeah. And maybe it's an archetype, but I kind of can't imagine many Viking men kind of wanting to do that.
No.
You don't sort of see them
surrendering.
Like, yeah, quite, you know, sort of reeds in the wind, as it were.
No.
They don't bend, do they?
So. No. And so it wasn't okay for men to do. Having said that, there were a lot of side madra, as they were called,
okay.
around. And in fact,
is that where we'd get the word master from? Side master.
Yes, it does
right.
mean side master.
Okay, yeah.
And there were plenty of them around. And indeed, one of the kings of somewhere in Norway at one point, he killed 80 of them.
Right.
And threw their bodies in the sea.
As a kind of clear up job.
Yeah,
right.
Clear up. And you know, like if in a community, there were 80 people.
Yeah, he could find that many.
Then you know. It can't have been that rare for men to practice.
No.
But it's like it wasn't okay. And I think that, you know, that's very different for men to practice in our cultures. There's plenty of guys practicing Sais
okay,
now.
Okay, so, I mean, it's yeah, that was really the historical stereotype.
You know, most men who practice shamanism are frankly not that worried about their sexuality, you know, about wanting to be super macho.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay for us. You know, but it wasn't okay in those times.
Okay, so I'm getting the picture of obviously back historically it was a woman's tradition, but nowadays it's Viking. Now I know it's historically inaccurate, but I kind of picture almost you could go for the sort of Valkyrie type things here. I mean, you're not wearing sort of, you know, horned helmets or...
Well, I'm certainly not.
Okay.
I'm wearing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt usually.
All right, so what would I see? I go to this Sais ceremony.
Just like most traditions, there are kind of community forms, there are community rituals, and there are, if you like, individual practice. And what I'm going to talk about now is, I guess, the community form of Sais.
Okay, yeah.
So if you went as a participant, what would, you know, you're living in the modern equivalent of a farm in Greenland, which I guess now is probably, you know, a flat in London.
Okay.
You go along to some sort of shamanic gathering and there's a Sais happening, what would you see? You would see the vulva or seeress, and I'm going to use the vulva, the female form, just because it's easy to talk that way, sitting on a high seat. All of the, what I mean by a high seat is some sort of raised seating.
Okay.
Now, for some reason, this seems to make a difference. And in all of the sagas, they talk about this side hall, and it seems like it's some sort of raised up seating. Don't know what. And there are some descriptions that make it sound like it's some sort of fish drying rack, which sitting on a fish drying rack, that sounds very strange
to me. It does, yeah.
But if you imagine that, you know, somebody said to me the other day, well, if you imagine you're in a Viking long haul,
yeah.
And there's loads of, you know, straw and animals and children and stuff around,
yeah.
Maybe you want to be raised up above that, separated from it slightly. You would see a circle of singers.
Mm.
Surrounding the high seat.
Okay.
And in fact, in the sagas, the seeress or seer usually seem to travel with a group of singers.
Right.
Now, there's a description in the saga of Eric the Red of someone called Thorbjörg Lillivolver, Thorbjörg Littlevolver.
Right.
And she's the last of nine sisters who used to travel round together practising side. And okay. You can imagine it, one of them would be on the high seat and the others would be singing. So there's this group of singers, and then there's a community that is being foretold for.
Right.
And the Volva would be carrying as her main shamanic tool a staff.
Mm.
And that brings in, if you like, the three main elements of a side. You'd have the high seat, but as the main shamanic tools, you'd have the staff and the song. And the staff, you know, there's lots of other traditions, shamanic traditions around the world that use staffs.
Yeah.
Often using two staffs, I think, like on the northwest coast, there's a tradition with of using two staffs together and banging them on the floor.
This is northwest coast of America,
Northwest
Pacific coast.
Yeah, Pacific coast has as a tradition of using staffs. But here in Britain, there's also one of the hill figures.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because I'm aware of that one. People often say it's maybe he was measuring. It's like, you know, kind of Neolithic surveyor or something. But
yeah, but maybe he was, you know, doing shamanic work with his two staffs.
Yeah.
And so there's the staff, and people have described the staff as being like a, you know, like a connection to the earth.
Mm.
When you're doing this very wild, connecting with this very wild nature energy, you know, it's important to have some sort of connection
to grounding. Be grounded,
And the staff seems to be that for a lot of people.
Right. Okay.
But then probably the other important element is the song. And in the sagas, it's very clear that the side couldn't take place without the song.
And they were specific songs, presumably.
They were specific songs.
Yeah.
In this Eric the Red saga, this woman, Thorbjörg, she comes to this farm, and nobody who lives on the farm knows the song anymore.
Right.
Because it's right at the end of the period where this is happening.
People are becoming Christian. And...
Yeah, and the only woman who knows the songs is, in fact, one of the Christians.
Okay.
And she's very reluctant to sing. And she's persuaded because there's famine. And actually what they want her to foretell is, when the hell is this famine going to end?
Right.
So she's persuaded to sing this song and to teach it to the women in the community. And they all sing it. And the Volva says, when you sang, the spirits drew near and listened.
Right.
You know, and they tell me that the famine is to end soon.
Okay. I'm kind of aware of the Lakota Uwupi ceremony tradition where the shaman invites the spirits. It's not obviously quite the same in that they don't quite talk through him in the same way, but you have specific singers that sing specific songs, and it doesn't happen. It's like, you know, the songs kickstart the ceremony. They're the kind of the powerhouse for it.
And I think that's certainly true in the side. You know, that with a good side song.
Yeah.
The Volvas take off into the non-ordinary reality, you know, very, very quickly.
Okay.
Now and with a bad side song, it's like trying to, you know, push a car uphill. It's terrible.
Okay. Now, from my own sort of knowledge of medieval music and stuff, that I know that there are the words to some of the Viking Edda, but there's no surviving music, and there's a German group called Sequentia that have reconstructed some of the music and they perform these, and I'll stick some of that music on at the end of this podcast so people can have a taste of it. But surely there's no side songs left.
Well, that's kind of true, and it's kind of not true.
Right.
One thing to say is that the sagas often talk about the Volvas learning with fins.
With fins?
Fins.
From Finland?
Fins, from Finland.
Okay.
And what they mean is they learn their magic from the Sami.
Ah, right.
And obviously there's a lot of Sami music that survives. Now, if we look at the descriptions of side music, they often say that it was beautiful, but they can also say it was wild, like the cries of wild birds.
Right.
And that it was powerful.
Right.
And if you think about some of the yoik music...
Okay, because that's the Sami songs, isn't it, the yoik?
It's very, very powerful and very, very wild.
Yeah.
And I think, so there's that tradition that we do have surviving musical from. So there's yoik, and then there's also these Scandinavian records of the cries they use for animal herding, which are... You know, there's this description of side that is song that it's like the cries of wild birds.
Right.
And these animal cries are very like the sound of wild birds. So
okay.
We do have that. And then, like any recovered shamanic tradition, we can go back to the same sources
that
our ancestors got from. Because, you know, the rocks are the same, the sky is the same, the trees are the same, the spirits are the same. So, you know, we can go back to the original source of this.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
get
it had to
come
from somewhere in the first place.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
And presumably the vulvas would sort of go out and kind of almost collect songs from the land, as it were. Yeah. You know, go out with a sort of butterfly net and grab them.
Well, I presume so. Another part of this side tradition is a practice called utisetta.
Okay.
And utisetta means outsitting.
Right.
And you might think about sitting as a kind of mini form of vision quest.
Okay.
The practice was to go out and spend the night out, usually sitting on something, sometimes a rock, but most often in the sagas they sat out on burial mounds.
Right, okay.
And the most powerful burial mounds to sit on were the burial mounds that contained bodies of dead
right,
seeress.
So they're really connecting with the ancestors.
Yeah, so it seems like it's very ancestral.
Yeah,
And in fact, there's a saga, Voluspa, which is in which Odin summons out of her burial mound the spirit of the first vulva, the Ur-vulva.
Right.
It's like visiting the first shaman.
Which
I think, you know, many of us have encountered in our shamanic practice.
Yeah, sure, going right back to the source,
So that's definitely, you know, quite common. And I think they would have got their songs from practices like utisetta.
And I guess that also would have been an act of power. I mean, in shamanism, we have to kind of face our little self that really, you know, doesn't want to get off the settee. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking of things like the Tibetan practice of chod, where you'd go to a pretty gruesome sort of charnel ground and you'd invite the beasties to come and eat you. And, you know, this is scary stuff. So I guess, you know, spending the night on a tomb in that way is an act of power, which in a way gives you the merit to get the song in the first place.
And in fact, these burial mounds of seeresses, they weren't actually something you wanted to have.
Right.
Around.
Okay.
They were considered to be powerful places. And in fact, you know, there's one of the stories, somebody digs up the body of a seeress and moves it off their land.
Right.
You know, and then reburies it with all kind of, you know, honour.
Just to get it off their land.
But they don't want it on their land.
Yeah.
You know,
they
don't want to have that, you know, that powerful spirit hanging around their place, I guess.
No, I guess so. And it's a bit like some of the other sort of dreaming with the dead traditions. I'm aware of a Berber tradition from North Africa, where villagers will go and sleep with the dead. They have kind of like tombs which are almost like ossuaries, the place where the bones are, and you'd go and sort of spend the night there, and you dream of your ancestors.
Mm, interesting.
So I guess, you know, there's some of that there too. Yeah, very much. And it probably, I mean, if you're going to stay up all night, you probably are in a dream state.
Absolutely.
You know,
at least partially so.
At least, yeah.
And particularly if you're in a sacred site like a burial mound.
And scared shitless.
And scared shitless, yeah. I once spent a night in a burial mound or Wayland Smithy, which is on Ridgeway in Britain.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the night, some ordinary reality drunken people came to visit me. And I think I scared them shitless. Because I thought they were non-ordinary when they first arrived and thought, oh, right, okay. And then they were ordinary. And
you emerged out of the tomb.
In the pitch black. So, still.
Okay, so we've got this priestess. What's she wearing? Just basically, I mean, in our culture, it would be normal clothes. And I guess in Viking culture, it would have been normal clothes,
In fact, the only description we've got of her, of one of them's costume, which is from this saga of Eric the Red, it very much talks about her wearing quite special clothes. She wears catskin gloves.
Right.
Cats were the sacred animal of Freya.
Interesting. I'll just go off from there, because I was watching a television programme the other day that was talking about the River Mersey in Britain, and the fact that it was sacred to a cat goddess. Apparently there was there's rock carvings which go back 2,000 or 3,000 years of cat-headed female figures.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
So, yeah, that cat thing. Sorry, I'm kind of going off the track of it, but that just reminded me so much of that. It's very interesting that Freya is a cat goddess. I didn't realise that.
So she's wearing catskin gloves, and she's wearing a blue cloak, and she's wearing a bag which contains her charms, the charms that she needed to do her work.
Right.
No more is said about them.
Okay.
But that could be, you know, runes. That could be a set of rune stones.
Yeah, yeah.
Though they weren't really used in that quite that way in that time. We don't think they weren't written in the same way.
Okay. Are there any archaeological remains at all?
Yeah, there are actually. There is a burial, or I think even two that they found that contains a woman with staves and with bags full of exactly the same sort of stuff that you might find in your or my medicine bag.
Really?
You know. You know, bits of bone and stone,
okay,
and
yeah.
Things with things written on them, and, you know, incomprehensible.
We don't change, do we?
We don't.
Thousands
much.
Of years go past, we don't change.
But one of the things about this tradition is you know, the community form of it is very much an oracular tradition. Is
okay.
Usually an oracular
That's
tradition.
An oracle.
An
yeah.
oracle.
Yeah.
So people are foretelling the future,
okay.
And the spirits generally in say seem to come to the vulva and speak through her.
Okay.
So it's more of a mediumistic tradition.
Right, so she's really just becoming a it's like her spirit goes out of her body and the spirit of the that actually is giving the messages comes in.
Sometimes but not always.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, they're sitting there and their teacher is sitting next to them.
Kind of like whispering in their ear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And sometimes they journey, but it's more often the answers come to them than they go out
right.
to find the answers.
Right.
Than in other shamanic practices that I've been involved in.
So I guess, like many native ceremonies, somebody would host this, would probably invite the singer and the vulva to come and do the ceremony, and they would kind of put on everything. They'd probably provide food, I guess, maybe
yes.
at the end of it.
Yes.
And then that person, the host, would kind of come in front of the seer when the seer was in trance and
awesome.
Say, when's the famine going to
yes.
end? Or,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly that. And in fact, this same story in Eric Ressler, it goes into great detail about the meal that they prepared
oh, right,
for the vulva.
Okay.
They fed her the hearts of all the animals that lived on the stead.
Really?
And it was important that she couldn't foretell until she spent the night there.
Okay.
And if you imagine, it's like she had to come in relationship with
the
land spirits,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
the spirits of the place. Which makes sense if
yeah.
you think about it as being connected with this
yeah,
nature
indeed.
Power.
And eating the hearts is
yeah,
interesting
yeah.
too. And a question that I was thinking a little while ago, you were talking about the high seat as being possibly a fish rack.
Yeah.
And that got me thinking a little bit about whether fish, because they were so important as a food source, were sacred to the Viking. Now, I don't know anything about that.
I don't know anything about that.
But it's a little bit like you're sitting in a place of the food, because that's the central thing. I mean, we live in a society where food is not central.
No.
And we don't realise that. I mean,
no.
you know, it's like we go and get something from Tesco's or, you know, the local supermarket or whatever. But to a society that, you know, it's really essential if the fish are in the field.
Mm. And in fact, quite a lot of the stories of this are written down. A lot of the sagas are written down in Iceland.
Yeah.
Or are written down about Greenland. And
Greenland was one of the last places to become Christianized, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Greenland in particular is right on the edge of if you think cultivatability.
Yes.
You know, farming is only just viable.
Yeah.
And it's not always very viable at all.
No.
And, you know, I think these are some of the reasons that a lot of the saith, if they're... There's oracular saith, but there's also saith where they're raising power to change something.
Right.
For example, to call the fish back to
okay.
the field.
Right.
And indeed, in the Erik the Red saga, she says that the famine will come to an end soon.
Right.
And you don't really know, has she just foretold that or has she made it
actually
happen?
Actually done, yeah, quite.
And I think this is to do with the fact that it's very connected to nature.
So how would you do that in terms of it being a power side? You'd actually use the whole ceremony to kind of raise power, and then with the intent of the seeress, or
being,
the seer, if it was a male
yep,
one, then he would kind of like focus it on that change work
yeah,
that was needed.
Yeah, and
right.
then let it go, if you like.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It'd be like a kind of bow and arrow, really.
Yeah,
yeah right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. It's interesting about Greenland, because obviously Greenland's got its own shamanic tradition anyway, from the Inuit people there. Angloc or something they're called. I can't.
Angakok.
Angakok. That's right. The, yeah. the Greenlandic shamans. And I wonder what the connection between the Vikings and the Angakok shamans were there.
There's very little said about that. I mean, there's much more said about the fact that they learnt their magic from the Finns.
Right.
You know. Yeah. She studied with two Finns, or two Finns lived in the house. You know. Right. So there's much more said about the Sami people than about the Inuits. But, you know, I don't think they had a lot of close contact.
No, well, I guess Greenland was one of the last places to be contacted anyway from the Vikings, wasn't it? Mm. Because it's so far out, so they would have taken their tradition with them. I guess it's interesting, too, with the Sami people, because I always consider the Sami to be sort of the westernmost Siberian tribe. I know it's kind of technically not correct, but to me they're almost a continuation of the whole sort of Siberian shamanic.
Yes.
You know, they're kind of like the very edge of
Arctic.
It.
Arctic.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it's that sort of geographic area. So I guess in a way that also connects the side into that, you know, tenuously, but it does connect it into that sort of whole Siberian shamanic tradition.
And I think if you look at that whole Siberian shamanic tradition as being the same shamanic tradition in some ways that spreads into North America.
Well, yeah, quite. Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of what we've talked about today, Nick, does touch on, you know, there are a lot of similarities of Scythe with some of the medicine practices,
right.
The outsitting.
Right. Yes.
You know, the sort of like use of magic, the magical tradition and the prayer tradition, which I think are both part of the medicine,
The
medicine
yeah.
way. So I think there are, you know, some real strong similarities.
Absolutely.
And also you mentioned earlier the Yuwipi.
Yes.
Another thing that it talks about quite a lot is when they do this faring forth in animal form.
Right.
They're usually described as lying under their cloak or being covered with a bull's hide.
Which, of course, is so much like the Yuwipi, where the medicine man is bound up in a star quilt and tied and everything. Yeah, yeah.
So there are some, you know, I think real similarities
across absolutely. I think that must be
true. But I think that's probably because, you know, nature's the same wherever you
and
go.
And we're the same.
And we're the same.
Yeah.
And there's only so many ways we can meet her.
And the spirits teach in, you know, much the same way wherever. What does the word Sile actually mean? Do you know what the literal translation is?
Well, it's an interesting question. And different people would put it in different ways. My understanding is it's the same word as seething.
Seething.
You know, like seething with anger.
Okay.
Bubbling.
Okay,
with anger.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And it also has, for me, that quality of Richard Katz's book, Boiling Energy, with the Bushmen in the Kalahari, where they do the healing work.
Yes.
That boiling energy.
Yes, yes. The name of which I can't remember at the moment, but I know what you
mean.
And
for me, that is the energy of letting that full power of nature flow through you.
Yeah. Now that's interesting, even to the roots of the word shaman. As I understand it, I've heard various versions of what actually the word shaman means, but one of them is to heat up, and the other is that it's a river of fire.
Yeah.
Which is that whole boiling. It's energy.
It's
I guess
energy.
We're talking about energy.
Energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or power.
Yeah.
Or. Yeah. It's energy, but energy to me makes it feel very impersonal.
Okay.
And it's a bit of a New Agey sort of term.
Yeah, yeah, kind of feel the energy.
And power also has that sort of power over connotation. And it is the power of nature.
Okay.
It's the natureness. It's the...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's power coming through us. I mean, I always like the Native American idea of the hollow bone.
Yeah.
You get out of the way and it comes through you. And if you've got stuff in the bone, you're blocking it and it can't come through. Mm. And I guess that's intrinsic. I mean, otherwise with Syed, you could have a field day telling people what you wanted. If you know, you could be quite manipulative potentially. But then I guess that would be the same in any shamanic tradition.
I think that's true in any tradition.
Yeah.
I think, you know, with the Syed, when what you see sometimes with people on the high seat when they're doing oracular work, often we get people to first of all answer a question for the community,
right?
Because that's good to bring the circle, to make sure that the circle of singers are all involved.
Yeah.
But then we let the devolver answer individual questions.
Right.
And sometimes it's, we've experimented with having three or even five people
really,
on the
high
side.
Really, not just the one person, right?
No, it's very powerful with more than one, because okay. you often seem to get different aspects of the same answer from
okay.
the three people.
Yeah, I can see that.
And it can be very good to have a range of different people on the high seat. But sometimes when you've got new people, you will see them gradually begin to run out of connection.
Okay.
You know, you can only stay in a trance state.
Okay, it's like static on the line. They lose it. Yeah,
and their answers gradually start to include things that the spirits wouldn't say.
Okay,
it was interesting the other day. I was at a side, and there were a couple of people on the high seat, and one of them suddenly started using a lot of New Ageisms.
Okay, that would be a bit of a giveaway,
and
wouldn't it?
You're like, the spirits don't talk like this,
right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
And conversely, you can have very powerful experiences, you know, where people give extremely direct answers.
Right.
And extremely tricksy answers.
Right. I can imagine the spirits could be quite brutal at times.
Very brutal.
Yeah.
Very brutal.
Yeah. I call a spade a spade.
Yeah. You know, particularly if the person's foolish enough to answer those yes or no questions.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And I guess you must get some pretty dumb questions too.
Yeah, you know. Why are you asking me this? That's a stupid question. Don't ask
me that.
They'll
say things like that.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. My person who taught me side mostly is a woman called Annette Hust, who's a Danish woman.
Right.
And she always says, never ask questions you don't want to know the answers to.
That's pretty wise.
And I think that's a very wise saying for any shamanic work, but particularly for this side, because...
Yeah.
Frankly, your own spirit teacher is more likely to be kind to you than someone else's spirit
teacher.
Well,
this teacher. Is probably true, yes.
You know.
Yes, yes. So people in Britain, I guess in Europe too, they can work with Annette?
Yeah, Annette's teaching, she teaches both in southern Sweden and in the UK. And
okay.
she's got workshops coming up in the next year in both.
Okay.
And she teaches, so from a very shamanic viewpoint.
Yeah.
She's a shamanic practitioner of many years standing.
Yeah.
So.
She's connected with Jonathan Horowitz, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's part of the same sort of team, as it were.
Yeah. And so, you know, she teaches it from a very shamanic place.
Yeah.
The other people who are practicing side, particularly in the States, but a little bit in the UK, are heathens,
okay.
i.e. pagan,
right.
Norse pagans.
Right, right.
Who teach it, who learn it as a shamanic practice that is associated with their religion.
Okay.
And there's a bunch called in the States called Hrafnar, which means raven.
Right.
Which are organised by a woman called Diana Paxson in San Francisco.
Okay.
And she's also teaching.
So Annette doesn't teach in the States?
No.
Right.
No, I'm afraid. You'll have to invite me to come and teach in the States if you want somebody to come and teach over
Okay,
there.
People in America, invite Karen. I can recommend her. She's good.
Oh dear.
And anything that people could read on the subject?
There's a very good book by a woman who's both an anthropologist and a Saith practitioner.
Oh great, coming from both sides.
Yeah, and she both talks about the academic sort of sources and about what it's like to do side.
Yeah.
And she's called Jenny Blaine, and her book's called The Nine Worlds of Side Magic.
Okay, Nine Worlds of Side Magic. Sounds good.
That's probably the best thing around.
Right. And
unless you speak Danish, in which case Annette Hust also has a book out.
Okay. And we had an article in Sacred Hoop magazine from Annette some years ago. I can't remember on earth what issue number it was, but have a look on our website and on the back issues there, it'll be there. And if we haven't if we haven't got that back issue for sale, then most of them are actually online for free download. So there's a good chance that if it's sold out, you can just grab it and have a read of it.
All right.
Karen, thank you. That was really, really interesting.
You're very, very welcome.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
So that was Karen talking about side, and I hope you enjoyed it. I found it quite interesting. It would be really nice to have some more sort of interviews and things, and I do need to do that more whenever I get the opportunity for the podcast. I was actually going to try and interview some other people at the conference, but I'm afraid I ran out of time. It was very, very busy, actually. They worked us bloody hard. Breakfast at sort of 7:30 in the morning and straight into sessions and very little breaks and oh, the strain of it, the strain of it. So, please contact me. I love your emails coming to me. My email address, nick@sacredhoop.org. Websites to visit, sacredhoop.org, which is obviously the magazine, and as I put in the other podcasts earlier on, there's still the special offer to get the downloaded subscription, the e-subscription with a PDF sent, which you can have for £7.50 instead of £10. And I think the link is something like sacredhoop.org/offer.html. It's something like that. I honestly can't remember it. I should have checked it before I started the podcast, shouldn't I? Oh, culpa mea. So I've talked about it on other podcasts in the past. So what you really have to do is go back into history and listen to all of them, and then you can find the offer, and then you can get a cheap subscription to the magazine. This is a cunning plan. And other websites. This website, or this podcast's website, is www.3worlds.co.uk, and that's the number 3, not the word 3. That's also my gallery website, where I've got lots and lots of antique shamanic and Tibetan ritual objects for sale. Even if you don't buy the bits and pieces, go and have a look at them, because there's some great stuff on there. I really enjoy collecting. You know, for me, half the fun, well, more than half the fun actually, is actually just getting the goodies come to me, and I get my mitts on all these wonderful antique objects. So there's some interesting stuff there. So have a look, see if you like the bits and pieces as much as I do. My own personal website is nicholaswood.net, which has got music and bits and pieces on it, and all my craft work and all that sort of stuff. And I've now got a MySpace page with music, and the magazine's got one too, but there isn't very much on the magazine one yet. I need to kind of get it a bit more organized. But mine is www.myspace.com/Nicholas Breeze Wood. And some people have asked me why my name has got breeze in it. They seem to think it's some sort of medicine name, and in a strange way it is, because I've really kind of always liked the wind as a child. It was very important to me, but actually it's part of my proper name. It's my mother's maiden name, and was the name that she wanted me to have as a child. It's an anglicised Welsh name, and since I moved to Wales a few years ago, I have actually taken to using it more. It's anglicised for Aprys, and it got changed in England over the centuries to Breeze. So that's why I'm Nicholas Breezewood. Anyway, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed Karen rabbiting about the site. I think it's pretty interesting stuff, and I must admit the ceremony was very good. If anybody in the States wants Karen to come and do a workshop, she wasn't actually joking when she talked about that. She travels to the States quite often, and has been part of the organising of several shamanic conferences and things. She's a very experienced practitioner. And if you get in contact with me, nick@sacredhoop.org, I'll more than happily pass your emails to her. She really knows her stuff. And I personally found the side ceremony or ritual, or however you want to say it, that she did really very, very interesting. And in fact, Jan and I were arranging for her to come and perhaps do a small sort of teaching weekend with a group of us in Pembrokeshire, all the way across on the west coast of Britain rather than Karen's east coast. We can travel about in these small islands, you know, we know how to live. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and I will try and get another podcast to you very soon. In the meantime, like I said in my interview with Karen, here is the German group Sequentia. They are a medieval band that have done a variety of bits and pieces of music over the years, mostly sort of around the 11th to about the 14th century. They specialise in that sort of high medieval period. They've done Hildegard of Bingen and troubadour music and various other bits and bobs like that. This time they're going further back in time. They have used the instruments that the Viking world knew at the time, and they have looked at, from a very scholarly point, and I'm not quite sure how they've done it, but they have arrived at the sort of musical system that the Vikings would have known, the modes, the sort of the set of notes that the Vikings would have been quite familiar with. So as near as anybody can guess, this is pretty authentic, probably slightly better produced, i.e. they're classically trained rather than coming from more of a folk tradition, but it's still pretty authentic Viking music. So I hope you enjoy it, and this is one of the Eddas from an album that they produced a few years ago, which I believe was actually called Eddas. So enjoy the music, and I'll speak to you next time. Thanks, bye bye. Thank you.